Macy's Memorial Day rug sale and clearance is going on now with 50 to 70% savings. Discover 3-, 4-, and 5-piece rug sets, area rugs, scatters, and runners. Choose from contemporary and traditional styles. Plus, find incredible last act rug savings of 60 to 75%. We've got your rug. Don't miss our rug sale and clearance. Save 50 to 70% at Macy's Fine Rug Galleries and at Macy's.com. Savings off regular sale and clearance prices. Exclusions apply.
Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Paranormal Now on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Alan B. Smith, and I welcome you to join us as we traverse the cosmic highway of paranormal portals and tantalizing turnoffs. And I offer a special welcome to all of you this evening, because this is our third episode, which means we've got the show up and running live and going strong so far. So thank you for joining, thank you for supporting, and to all of our Instagram supporters and Facebook people, thank you again for following. If you're not familiar, you can follow Paranormal Now at Paranormal Now on Instagram, or you can go to Facebook, Paranormal Now Radio. Coming up tonight, my main attraction would be Ken Cherry, the author of The Stephenville UFO, Mark Slade Investigates. It's a great book. He was a former MUFON UFO investigator for director for Texas, and the founder of Epic Voyages Investigations, and the radio show that you can be found by the similar name, Epic Voyages Radio, on the Inception Radio Network. Before I get to Ken Cherry, and you know that'll be in about 20, 25 minutes or so, there are a couple things that I wanted to do tonight and comment on. Now, this may sound strange. Slave children of NASA. Aliens running our lives. The Sandy Hook incident. Pizzagate. And what has kind of been known in jest, Picklegate. And for those of you who are familiar, these are referring to Alex Jones, with the exception of the aliens controlling us. He typically stays away from the alien topic. Before I get to that, my lead-in is something about the media, and that's really what this whole episode is about, the beginning of this episode, because I'm doing something I've never done before. I've never gone out there and really given my opinion or commentary on things that I typically leave for the guests. And this won't be a common thing. It's not going to be an everyday feature of the show. But, you know, there's some things that really have gotten out of control and really upset me about not only the online trolling, but the media trolling us, trolling you. You know, the hyperbole and trying to get your attention and try to stoke your fear. And everyone does this. From the main media channels, the channels like Alex Jones you'll find on YouTube. I mean, the guy's got millions and millions of followers. But I want to focus first on the issue of George Norrie and Art Bell. We lost Art Bell a few weeks ago, and it was a really sad time for all of us who grew up loving the paranormal, hearing his voice on Coast to Coast AM, and then eventually George Norrie took over. And a lot of you guys are familiar with, they had something of a feud, if you will. Now, I'm an objective observer, just like you are, but you know, I've also spent time in theater, a little bit behind the camera, and spent some time doing radio now. And I do understand that sometimes things are said, even by Art Bell, to get your attention and to get you to follow that show, whatever it be. Maybe it's Dreamland, maybe it's Coast to Coast, or Midnight in the Desert. So often you would hear Art Bell refer to that other show on his platform, referring to Coast AM. And, you know, sort of stoking an anti-Coast to Coast, you know, like we're the cool guys, we're the good guys, listen to our show, we're the real deal. And to some extent, that's true for some of us who listen to that program. But then there are other aspects of the other program that we like, right? So I always saw Art Bell as something of an entertainer. He brought us really fascinating and interesting information, but he always wanted to make it enjoyable. So do I know whether Art Bell really hated George Norrie or not? I have no idea. But I'm going to play something for you. This was George Norrie's reaction when he found out on the air, or moments before he went on the air to Coast AM, that Art Bell had passed away. And I'm playing this because I'm coming from a former actor's point of view, that this sounds as sincere as it can get. And then I'll comment a little bit on that after we hear this piece.
Charles, I'm at this point where I think I have enough information now to go with this story. So stand by, folks. Here we go. We're getting reports, and we have been over the last 30-some minutes, that Art Bell has died. I'm trying to get my composure here, folks. He was 72 years old. Our senior producer, Tom Danheiser, and executive producer Lisa Lyon and Jimmy Church have been working this story all night. I'm going to go to Tom in the L.A. studio.
George, I'm right here. It's a very sad night. I just got off the phone with George Knapp, and a press release was sent to all the media. It simply read, "Community announcement, longtime resident and radio show host Art Bell died today at 72 years old in his home in Pahrump, Nevada." It's truly a sad night. We've got such fond memories, and it's just something that's unbelievable, really.
You know, Art and I were not that close. We had our differences. But he was one of those instrumental in me being where I am right now.
But I know, even with your differences, that you guys always kept the audience in mind, and you still do. And so that was a common thread that you guys had together.
God, he just had his second little baby.
Yeah.
And gosh.
So that is George Norrie's reaction. And you know what? To me, that sounds absolutely authentic and sincere, and he's not doing it for the show. And there are a lot of people out there who will charge that. And I'm really sick of is this constant attack on people's characters that you don't know. Look, he admitted that they had a differences, right? And you know, there was a sort of war between Art Bell and Coast to Coast AM. But granted, the guy, you know, wanted people to listen to his program, which was no longer Coast to Coast AM. That may have been his baby. Things changed. And yes, there are things about George Norrie that people make fun of and things about Art Bell that people don't like. Just because you don't like George Norrie's style, why do you have to go online and hate on him, right? Why do you have to post hateful things? And it just seems like such a petty thing to bring up, right? Like, Alan, who cares that people are just – that are making these trolling comments? But I think it matters because it's that kind of fervent excitability that people tap into. You know, so as soon as we can find something to judge on somebody, judge about someone – then it's easier to bring them down, to attack them. And then you can, little by little, bring those people who are already sort of leaning towards your direction closer and closer. And when you fuel emotion and you fuel hatred, if you will, or sincere cynicism or deep cynicism, then you're playing that game. and you're trying to get numbers. You're trying to get people to listen to what you have to say and listen to your show. I think we should just move on, you know, accept that George was different than Art, and be feel blessed and grateful that we had Art for the time that we did. I mean, he changed the landscape of talk radio and the paranormal, ufology, cryptozoology awareness. Another thing I wanted to bring up was I also saw some comments about George Tsukalo from Ancient Aliens. And some of the criticisms were that he was not an expert, that he didn't have the backing to be a ufology expert. Well, I understand that, you know, someone should have a background if they're going to investigate a UFO sighting, an eyewitness event. You need to have some sort of training to do that. In this field, there is no university for ufology. Not really. I know MUFON has a program, but it's essentially a program to learn to investigate events under the guise of MUFON. But you can't go and get a BA in ufology or a master's in ufology and go out there. Now, if you put someone on a show and you just say, they're an expert, that doesn't make them actually an expert. So in this case, I agree with that. And a lot of us who are doing talk shows like this will go on and you know, pretend to be experts when we're not. And then there are those who did not get training but did the work. They went out there and they researched. They wrote about it. They blogged about it. They published a book. You know, they collected findings, collected data in the best way that they knew how. And garnered experiences and information from eyewitnesses, you know, and for example, I will say, someone like Heidi Hollis, she is considered an expert on shadow people. That's because she did the work. She went out there and she did the work and brought it the awareness and, you know, collected a series of experiences and stories and then did the best she could at the time and continues to do so. And she grows in her research to come up with a theory, with an idea. And that's okay. You know, so just because someone doesn't have a background training in something paranormal, that doesn't mean that they don't deserve the right to be on a television show or a radio station or write a book. I mean, you could go out there and do it, right? I mean, how many people start businesses without any training in business? I think that's cool. It's awesome. Go out there and do it. If you're interested in something, go out there and do the footwork. So what do you call someone, you know, that is on a show like Ancient Aliens but doesn't have a training? You could say specialist, maybe in that field, expert. I don't know. But I feel like, you know, attacking someone just because they don't have a training background in that particular venue is really unfair. It's the quality of their work that matters. So if you don't like something that a so-called expert says, or if you find flaws in their theories, then have that argument. But character assassination, that's not going to help us. That's not going to help this whole field moving forward. It's hard enough that the world of, in my case, I love ufology, probably over all things, but the entire paranormal world, it's we're ostracized as it is to be investigating and talking about these things. So when we go after our own, just to get on our own high horse, which is I kind of feel like I'm doing that right now. So I want to get off the soapbox, but you know, I think that's unfair. So I'm going to leave that at that. The other thing that I think is very important, and it's been on my mind for a long time, and it's really, really, it really ticked me off, are some of the things that have come out of Alex Jones' mouth. Alex Jones from InfoWars, if you're not familiar with InfoWars. Alex Jones, I first heard years ago as a guest on Coast to Coast AM. Now, granted, I've not heard him on there as a guest for quite some time. But years ago, I did hear him, and I started listening to his show. And, you know, his alternative investigative news slash talk radio program, I thought for a time was a little enlightening. You know, he made me aware of this idea of a more global elite, the Bilderberg Group, and, you know, people behind the scenes that have power and influence over the world. I'm not sold that there's an Illuminati, but I'm not closed off to that at all. But after a while, I felt like he was getting more and more outrageous. And in step with what I was just saying, I feel like he was attacking other people to get attention. He was sensationalizing his own already alternative and for some extreme ideas to bring in more viewers, to get you worked up. And so I'm going to I'm gonna play a clip here for you, and this is in reference to before I do that, I want to bring something up. On one of his shows, he had a guest come on, and the guest mentioned that there's child slavery on Mars run by NASA. So let me just break this down really fast for you. So here are some of my problems with the child slavery on Mars thing. One, even if you were to abduct children or breed children and bring them to Mars, you would have to train those children to function in hostile environment like space and Mars. So they can't be kept naive or ignorant. They need training. They need, you know, physical and scientific training. They need survival training. They have suits that they have to wear. They have gear and, you know, scientific instruments that they need to use in order to navigate space. And even more so once you get to Mars, right? So just on the surface of it, this is crazy, because now basically you have to have kids that are smart. And to have kids that are smart, they'll eventually grow up to be adults that are smart. And so I just find it highly implausible that children would grow up on Mars, you know, walking around in a very low gravity situation where they have to have trained procedures for survival situations, unexpected storms that can happen on Mars, radiation from the sun. And then they not figure out how to use communication devices? Of course they would. So why couldn't they figure out ways to... The fact that I'm even talking about this just kind of drives me insane, because I just think it's a little crazy. But, okay, so that's what got me started with the Alex Jones thing. So I was paying attention to some more of his outlandish ideas, and the one that really ticked me off the most was Sandy Hook. So I'm going to play a clip for you from Alex Jones' own mouth, what he had to say about Sandy Hook shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, December 14th, 2012.
Charles, I'm at this point where I think I have enough.
Okay, we lost the audio on that. Sorry about that. All right, well, so let me break this down for you. Basically, Alex Jones made the accusation that during the Sandy Hook shooting, there were behaviors that were odd, like drills. So the children were running in circles in and out of the building as if they were doing drills. That was one of his, you know, points of evidence. Also, he said that, you know, they weren't flying in choppers. And this is another point of a fact that he's trying to lay down as evidence. And the amount of time it took for this event to play out. I just don't understand why you would need to do that, even if your motivation is to defend the Second Amendment and to say that the global elitists are staging a hoaxed murdering, a slaughtering of children and their family to get us scared so that we willingly turn over our Second Amendment rights to carry weapons. So, the fact that millions of people listen to this and believe it is what upsets me the most. So let me play a clip here for you now of Alex Jones.
And we have been over the last...
Oh, we're not.
I just got to...
Okay, I'm so sorry. We're having technical
Here we go. Then you learn that it was the same Amarillo, the Lockheed Connection underwear bomber. Then those are big red flags that they were Patsy provocateurs. The classic MO has been followed. And then, yeah, it kind of becomes a red herring, you know, to say the whole thing was staged. Because they have staged events before. But then you learn the school had been closed and reopened, and you got video of the kids going in circles in and out of the building, and they don't call the rescue choppers for 2 hours, and then they tear the building down and seal it, and they get caught using blue screens, and a email by Bloomberg comes out in a lawsuit where he's telling his people, get ready in the next 24 hours to capitalize on a shooting. So Sandy Hook is a synthetic, completely fake, with actors, in my view, manufactured. I couldn't believe it at first. I knew they had actors there, clearly, but I thought they killed some real kids. And it just shows how bold they are that they clearly used actors. I mean, they even ended up using photos of kids killed in mass shootings here in a fake mass shooting in Turkey. So, yeah, or Pakistan. The sky is now the limit. I appreciate it.
Okay. So, again, I have seen the people on the news, and so have you, and your common sense and your heart and your gut tells you these are not actors. And this is disgusting. It's absolutely disgusting. And what upsets me about this so much with Alex Jones and the things that he says is that he is considered alternative media, and so are we. And people tend to sort of clump us together. It gives alternative media a bad name. So, okay, Sandy Hook, as horrifyingly insulting as that is to people who are alive, I mean, just think about the logistics of the number of actors that you would have to hire, and then their fake children would have to, that people knew for years and years and years, would somehow have to disappear somewhere. And where did they go? And then all the friends of the actors who were never actors in their entire life would have to be hired actors in order to corroborate their lifetime story as not ever being actors. It's just patently absurd. And so then we move on to Pizzagate. Pizzagate had a very real effect, a real-time effect on to show the dangers of working people up into a frenzy. So you had a gunman actually go into a pizza shop and shoot because they thought at this pizza joint that Alex Jones was, and I'm not going to say the name of the place, that Alex Jones was harping on for a long time, saying that there was child slavery happening underground or somewhere behind the doors of this pizza shop, and it had some connection to the Hillary campaign or Hillary Clinton. And because of the hyperbole, he actually worked somebody up enough to believe this, him and other people, of course, spreading this word online, to go in and shoot with a gun and demand to see the child slaves. Like, again, with the child slaves, what is this? The constant references to child slaves, and I hadn't mentioned it before, but Satanists, that apparently we're all under the order of Satanists. That I'll kind of leave, you know, aside for other discussions, but it's dangerous. It's dangerous what he does sometimes. And it's as a society, we have to call these people out. Because, and as a media, people in the media, and I wouldn't put myself in that category in the media per se. I'm, you know, a humble talk show person who does paranormal, and I love that. But there has to be a calling out, because we are undermining our own society when we're letting people like this trickle these theories little by little, and slowly and slowly into the subconscious, the conscious and subconscious, and the people start to buy into it.
I have to go back to memory, then saying, but then some of it looks like it's real, but then what do you do when they've got the kids going in circles in and out of the building with their hands up? I've watched the footage, and it looks like a drill.
When you say parents faked their children's death, people get very angry.
Yeah, well, that's all I know. But they don't get angry about the $500,000 dead Iraqis from the sanctions, or they don't get angry about all the
that's
illegals
pouring
in. No, it's not a dodge.
Okay, and that was a piece from his interview with Megyn Kelly. And she's right. She's right. That's a dodge. I mean, he knows that his – I don't even know if Alex Jones believes in this stuff. I really don't. But he knows that his theory is patently absurd on the surface of it. And so when he's under the hot lights of a mainstream media outlet, he is wiggling. He's not standing firm. His words are not solid, and he's not standing firm on his ground. He's bending a little bit, so that he sounds a little less ridiculous on mainstream media, which is funny because when I was watching this interview, I thought, wow, he's kind of betraying his followers by doing so, by not being as blatant as he would be on his own show.
You want us to cover Pizzagate? We have covered it. We are covering it. And all I know is, God help us, we're in the hands of pure evil. I love how the fake news is saying we're fake news, and they're specifically crapping themselves over Pizzagate, and their answer is to say it's all fake. No, WikiLeaks released this. This is it. Leaked all the Pizzagate stuff as a checkmate instead of them using this against our government. They've recruited pedophiles in the government. You know, have my reporters covering Pizzagate, and I've mentioned it some. Pizzagate, as it's called, is a rabbit hole that is horrifying to go down. Now, if you're a radio listener, this is a powerful video, but I've had it reposted. This is on InfoWars.com. Pizzagate is real. The only question is, what exactly is it? Let's go ahead and go to the report. Pizzagate is real. The question is, how real is it? What is it? Something's going on. Something's being covered up. Pizzagate is real. The only question is, exactly what is it? Kids being, I can't even say it on air, folks. The video, we're going to tweet it out with Breitbart's statement on InfoWars.com dealing with Pizzagate. You know, people want me to look into it. I may just have to take off a week and just only research this and actually go to where these places are and stuff. In fact, I'm looking at getting on a plane. I just like Bohemian Grove and stuff. I can't just say something and not see it for myself. They go to these pizza places. There's like satanic art everywhere. There's art of these people where they're shoving children into women's vaginas. That's why I can't cover Pizzagate that much.
All right, so I just want to give credit where credit's due. That compilation of Pizzagate was edited by Media Matter for America on YouTube. So again, this is a perfect example where he keeps repeating and repeating and repeating and repeating, and he's making broad, sweeping accusations and very salacious, nasty accusations at some pizza shop where the poor owner ends up getting having someone come in and shoot inside his business. This is crazy. Now, granted, there was a lawsuit against Alex Jones for that, and I don't know what happened. And also, as of late, there have been more people to join in the lawsuit against Alex Jones for the Sandy Hook incident, because a group of parents had gotten together and teachers and filed suit against Alex Jones for defamation and other things as well, because it's been over five years now, I believe, since Sandy Hook. So yes, there are repercussions to some degree for Alex Jones, but he keeps going. And then when his back's against the wall, he'll apologize. But you know that somewhere down the line there's going to be something else that he's going to jump onto the bandwagon and try to get people worked up about. Look, there's a lot of problem in the news media. CNN, Fox, MSNBC, all of them are slanted one way or the other. You know, CNN used to be headline news where you would get most of the broad scope of news, going on in America and a little bit of global news. And now they'll pick a few topics, maybe add one or two in as they go randomly throughout the day. And no matter what the program is, they'll run it over and over and over again. So it's really difficult to find good information out there. Now, I think that NPR News, even if you do think it slants a little bit liberal, on the whole, it's way more balanced than other radio news outlets. Same thing with PBS NewsHour. I think it's great. It's much more objective than most news shows. And also, they bring on one conservative, one liberal, and they talk things out. They discuss. They don't yell. It's not about entertainment. It's about information. And so the thing with Alex Jones is that he's about entertainment. He's about tapping into your emotions and triggering in a reaction. And so I'm adding this in partly for humor and partly just to elucidate the point that I'm making. This is what's been termed Picklegate. Hillary Clinton went on the Jimmy Kimmel Show during the campaign after she had been sick a little bit and staged a joke, to make fun of the fact that she's sick, and then, oh, now I'm healthy. So Jimmy Kimmel gave her a pickle jar, and she struggled to open it and opened it on live television just to prove, oh, I'm healthy. It was a gag. It was a gag. But this is Alex Jones.
Here it is. That's not how you open a can of pickles.
And he goes on and on and on about saying how you can't, when you open a jar of pickles, it has to pop. And he repeated this over and over and over again, trying to prove that Hillary was faking being healthy. Well, she was. That was the point. Everybody in the audience, everybody watching that show knew it was a joke. But Alex Jones took something that was blatantly fake on purpose for humor and tried to spin it into something that is... to drive hate towards Hillary Clinton. So I'm not here to get involved with political sides at all, but I'm just saying that I'm really just fed up with Alex Jones's, accusation, his behaviors, and other news outlets that work in tandem with him to spread this sort of venom that's only participating in keeping us divided. I have friends and family that are on opposite sides of the political spectrum, and we get along, and that's okay. But if we all start hating each other and all start thinking that every conspiracy theory is true, we'll get ourselves worked up in paranoia and anger and fear, and that's not going to help us. Okay, so I'm getting off my soapbox, and I promise you I won't do this all the time. My next guest coming up is Ken Cherry. He is the author of The Mark Slade Investigates the Stephenville UFO Novel. He is the former MUFON director for Texas, and he was on the scene in 2008 when the Stephenville UFO made its appearance on the scene, and this was a huge sighting. My personal opinion is that this was probably the best documented and the largest scale UFO sighting or approach that we've had to date, at least in the United States, to my knowledge. So Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks. Yeah. So you tolerated my bantering for a little while. I had you on the line there for a bit.
I didn't catch it all, but one of our investigators, really shouldn't mention his name. Anyway, his granddaughter was there at the Parkland school during the massacre. And, I know that they came in and offered her and all of her friends there counseling. It was just a devastating effect on, her parents or grandparents and the community at large. And so... I really didn't catch the gist of what Alex Jones was trying to get across, but certainly this was a very real event for everybody that was there and was a victim of this insanity. So I think these are the type of events that are easy for these sort of provocateurs to come along and, you know, make try to make a buck off of them, unfortunately. I think there was a saying around one of the previous White Houses, don't let any tragedy go away, you know, should not be wasted. So, you know, there's an opportunity there to make some sort of political hay. So it just depends on what you're peddling, I suppose. But
yeah,
anyway.
I think the worst part for me is the inhumanity of it, you know, and that you're basically, you know, shepherding people to believe in things that are really hurtful towards other people. And I think that's what really gets me upset the most. And because Alex Jones, for one example, you know, I just kind of picked on him tonight, but he has millions of followers, so he has a very real influence on Americans.
Well, he has a lot of listeners, that's for sure. And of course, the man with the gun showing up at the pizza parlor does show that he does have some influence among the fringe loonies. But I think I got to give most people credit and believe that they look at the man as primarily an entertainer. And now, that's not to say that there aren't conspiracies that exist. And of course, my field of ufology is just rampant with conspiracy theories, but some of them are pretty well founded. I mean, it can be documented as to, you know, the origins from government programs that were designed to misinform and cover up activities relating to, you know, sensitive, what they consider to be sensitive information about UFOs and some of the things they've done, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's an interesting thing to talk about, because in the world that we explore, as far as alternative in the way of paranormal ufology, etc., we do... you know, like yourself, you get sources of information, and you can't give away those sources, right? So you have to say, my source told me this. But what I notice with some people is that, you know, every other word is, oh, my source, someone told me this. I heard this from so and so. I heard that, and I begin to start doubting them, because you know, it's like when you speak too much. I feel like you're on the you're trying to deflect from any real critique, whereas like yourself, you know, I know that you've had your sources during the period of the Stephenville, and I'm guessing probably after, which informed your understanding of the UFO phenomena, and I take your word on that, because you know you are sober in your approach. It's not, you know, you're not out there trying to, you know, stoke the fires and you know, just to make millions. I mean, you really care about this stuff, and it's meaningful to you, and it always comes across that way to me.
Well, let me be clear about one thing. There is no money in this pursuit. If anything, it has cost me a great deal of money. During the Stephenville active investigation with MUFON, there was a one-year period where my personal income from a business that I own dropped from a healthy six figures down to barely enough to pay my property taxes. So, I mean, it was all-consuming. And, I mean, between the phone ringing day and night and... you know, interviews and that sort of thing, and coordinating the specialists that we had working on the case and the investigators. We had two dozen or so people over a period of a year involved in that investigation, ranging from, you know, scientists to that did research on some of the photographs that we had from witnesses and various things. But at any rate, I don't take anything for granted until I have more than one source that is unrelated. And, I kind of take the information and take it down and, you know, put it in the box for that particular piece of data. And then if I get confirmation from one or two other sources, then I give it some credibility. And there were a number of instances where, from all of the massive amount of publicity that the Stephenville event gained for such a long period of time, I received phone calls from people from various government agencies and people purporting to be from government agencies. Some that I met, some, frankly, that I got to know quite well, and others that I knew by name and reputation, where you could Google them and find that they had a long history of government work and, you know, were legitimate scientists, for instance. So one by one, I would hear similar stories from different sources, and it began to paint a very clear picture of, you know, what had taken place and what really is at stake.
And this is the UFO, the incident, the Stephenville UFO incident.
Not only the UFO incident in Stephenville, but really the meaning behind it and, the history of this cover-up that has taken place in our country now for, 70 years or so. So it was quite sobering, as a matter of fact. So at any rate, one thing that I do walk away with is that there must be, from the various agencies and scientists that I spoke with, thousands and thousands of people in this country that have intimate knowledge of really the reverse engineered technology that our government has possession of and has developed over the last 70 or so years and managed to keep it secret. It's amazing, and very much like the secrecy the surrounding the development of the first atomic bomb, of course. So there's many implications to that sighting. Go ahead.
Yeah. What would they be hiding? What kind of technology do you think they actually have?
Well, let me tell you. I'll try to be brief. A story from one very, very trusted source. This gentleman is one of the characters in my book. His name is Drake. Very real. As a young man, he joined the OSS, and during World War II, it worked with General MacArthur. And during the war, they viewed a number of UFOs and some of the occupants that were brought down either accidentally or on purpose during the war. That's kind of how he got involved in this whole secrecy and the UFO question. When I really got to know him, he was an older man, elderly quite actually, and retired. But he had said that at one point, he was the one of three men on a committee that had made the final black budget approval for the military. And One year, the request came to them. It was so large that they just refused to sign it, and they had this four-star general sitting there in front of them and said, look, you know, there's no oversight. This is such a huge amount of money that, you know, we're not going to sign it and approve of it until we know where it's going, how it's being spent. So he said they took them, the three men on the committee, to this enormous hangar. And in the hangar, he said, were all sizes of flying saucers, is the way he referred to them. And the general turned to them and said, that's where the money's going. Now, this was in the early 60s. Can you imagine what we have developed since then, in the last 50-some-odd years? And so this is the secret they don't want us to know. NASA was basically and is basically a sham. It's a make-work project. I've spoken to a number of high-level scientists from NASA who are paid through NASA, but basically their job is working on secret projects, back engineering, and working on different types of donated or retrieved technology. So what we have really in our arsenal is hundreds of years in advance of what the public is aware of. And there are other aspects of this that they don't want the public to know because they're concerned about the fear and the panic that it would create, just the uncertainty, the stock markets might crash, the economy could become frozen, people of religious faith might react, would not be able to handle it. There would be concerns on just about every aspect of society. So they have a tremendous stake, on the one hand, in withholding the secret from the public. On the other, there are very, very powerful people, and this is part of the conspiracy, who are holding back this knowledge, so that only a very elect few get the benefit of this technology and everything that it means.
I always wondered, you know how people say that there's this longevity technology or cure to cancer, these sort of things. And I always wonder, I see these people who are part of the global elites, and I see them getting older. You know, and I see that they have stints in the hospital and things like that. So I've always wondered about this whole idea that the cure to cancer, the cure to some viruses or old age is locked up only for these few people. Because I feel like now, especially since everyone is on camera, you know, is on Instagram or seen, and because of alternative news outlets, people are following them. And keeping tabs on them, we see them getting older. So if it's true that we have these technologies, why don't we see them playing out? Or do you have an opinion on that? Or?
Well, I think that the elite are very elite, and these are the type of people who do not, show up on panel discussions or at dinners and that sort of thing.
Think they're really behind the scenes?
Well, how many times have you seen a Rothschild on TV? So there are people who are at the very top of the pyramid that have the benefit of these technologies. But let me ask you this. Now, you know, we used to have the royalty in Europe 500-600 years ago. They were the only ones who could that had the financial wherewithal to build ships. And what did they do with those ships? So they went, they explored, and they found other cultures that they could either conquer or, you know, trade with. And, you know, Spain, England, Portugal, the Netherlands, all these countries in France, you know, and so forth, all became incredibly wealthy from the benefit of all this trade. So, I mean, it is man's nature to explore and, you know, covet, either try
covet
to
and hoard
with.
Yeah.
To take to one way or another get what other people have that they want. Mm-hmm. So I don't really think that mankind has changed that much in hundreds of years. So people who have this access to this technology aren't even necessarily here to be interviewed on television.
Yeah,
I mean, I know that sounds kooky, but if you have a craft, as Ben Rich, who was the head of the Skunk Works with Lockheed, who Skunk Works was responsible for many of the black budget programs. And anyway, he gave a speech before his death and said that we have the technology to take E.T. home.
Mm-hmm. Now, I recall that.
Since, and I know someone who personally asked him if he seriously meant that, and he said, yes, he did. And so if here's one of the few men on the face of the earth who would know that for certain, and if he said it, I believe it. And I know that we're not just running an Uber service for E.T., so what do you think we've been doing with those things for the last many decades? I mean, just flying around to get everybody excited about UFOs? No, well, partly, and that's part of the conditioning program to get people used to the idea before, you know, eventually it has to be disclosed. But in the meanwhile, they're out there, just let your imagination run wild, and it's probably happened where we've met extraterrestrials and viewed other worlds and other technologies and that sort of thing. So who says the elite have to be here? You know, they can.
Yeah, maybe they hit a certain age and then off they go. I mean, we're actually not too far from that. It seems to me maybe another, you know, 30 years or so we'll be able to start really rejuvenating our own DNA, especially with you know, the DNA gene splicing that we're able to do now with CRISPR and other technologies. But I do wonder, maybe we just got the propulsion technology, the spacefaring technology. You know, it's like if somebody were to crash a cruise liner into the beaches of you know, some deserted island where there are a few people that live there that don't know much about the technology. Even if they could back engineer the cruise ship, that wouldn't guarantee that they have, they understand what the medicines are on board. You know, would they be able to back engineer, you know, like an antiviral vaccine or something like this? You know, so I do wonder if we're limited in what we gained from those crash saucers and things like that.
Well, a great deal, actually. I have three sources who, worked at S4 in Area 51, working on back engineering programs, and each of the three scientists said that they worked alongside aliens. So apparently, you know, some of the technology we've gained has been through peaceful means. And, of course, there is a long-rumored deal, supposedly, that Eisenhower made in 1953, 54, you know, exchange technology for, you know, allowing the aliens to abduct people. But you know, aside from that, I know two of these scientists' names would be immediately recognizable, and they all told me independently this. So it's not that everything that we have came without an instruction booklet or someone to help us to understand it. Now, there are many different types of aliens, ETs visiting our planet, and so not all of the technology is the same, and so much of it does have to be studied and back engineered, and it's one reason why, you know, some of it hasn't been duplicated. So you hit the nail on the head there in that respect, but in other cases, though, we have had help. And so one of the scientists gave me a manuscript of a polygraph that he took. And remember a number of things that I recollect stuck out was, of course, that he had been threatened. His life had been threatened if he went public with things, because he was one of the sources that wanted to go public, but at any rate, he was threatened, and he did name a couple of other scientists who had been killed under suspicious circumstances that they thought were a security risk. Mm-hmm. And he worked on anti-gravity programs. I'm trying to think. One thing he had done is that he had inspected seven different craft over his career. And he had told me that he had just come back from Japan, where a UFO had crashed near there, Sea of Japan someplace. And so that was the closest facility to bring it in. And he was flown over as one of the scientific team to look at this thing. But he was saying that one thing that they discovered on board this craft was a liquid wall.
A liquid wall that they had
not figured out yet. So, some of the technology can be a complete surprise to us and upend some of our understanding of, the nature of our, existence. So,
reality,
anyway,
yeah.
liquid wall, right?
Liquid wall. Yeah. That's a good segue into what I was thinking earlier, and I really didn't mention it as much, because, you know, some of these things that we talk about on this program and other programs like it, I mean, and you and I in our private conversations talk about all kinds of other things as well that sound outlandish. But the fact is that you and I sitting here having a conversation about it, you know, it's a safe thing to do. You know, I don't feel like you and I are causing any havoc or negative effects in the world because of it. You know, so I'm much more comfortable,
Alan,
doing that.
Let me interrupt you there, because while you may have that feeling of security and safety, I gotta tell you that I have been amazed at how much scrutiny and intimidation I've been subjected to for not only for the content of my book, apparently, which is pretty thinly veiled as a novel, but for some of the things I've said in the interviews, because my phone has been tapped, and that's been my phone, my television, and my computer have all been bugged, as confirmed by my cable provider charger.
Oh yeah,
and,
yeah. I remember that incident. Yeah.
Yeah, and they've made harassing calls to people in the middle of the night all over the country, displaying my phone number. And then when people, you know, were awakened two or three times in the morning, then they see my number and they call and chew me out. I had 911 calls placed in with my number to the police department. I had my car GPS bugged. So, and I was, I'm going to forget. I had a dark SUV trying to run me off the road one night. And so, I mean, there have been, and I'm just one person who obviously is for disclosure, and I guess even though I've tried to make my comments rather couched, apparently it's ticked off the wrong people. I've come under the scrutiny of the wrong people. So,
no, yeah, I've borne witness to that. I understand that.
Yeah.
And from you as an investigator, I think that you have to deal with that much more than someone like myself who just, you know, sort of offers a platform and doesn't usually offer, you know, much commentary of my own on the subject. But what I was actually thinking more about was the effect that we have on, you know, society. You know, other than, you know, moving people towards disclosure, you know, I don't see any, you know, real world negative side effects that could hurt other people, not us, you know, but other people by having the discussions that we have, unless I'm missing something and you're more aware of that than I am.
No, from what I'm told by some trusted sources is that disclosure will come whether the powers that be want it or not. Part of what the purpose of the mass sighting in Stephenville was to gauge the reaction of the public. In other words, to prepare people for disclosure so that the more of these mass sightings there are, the more people get comfortable with the idea that, you know, there is this exotic technology running around in our atmosphere that our military can't do anything about, or at least the military assets that we know about. So part of a plan leading toward disclosure, but at any rate, I think that what we're doing is just helping to inform people and letting them know, hey, you know, you might want to get comfortable with the idea. But I'll tell you something. There has been an effort to educate the public and to prepare them for disclosure ever since the Robertson panel in 1952. That was one of their recommendations of the panel. That panel was formed as a result of the mass UFO sighting that took place over Washington, D.C. in July of 1952. And they even mention in their report that, you know, certain production companies, the Walt Disney Company, should be used, you know. And so over the years with the Star Treks and all the various sci-fi programs that have been so popular on TV, I found that most people are very accepting of the idea that, you know, there is other intelligent life in the universe. Matter of fact, most people would, I think the anyone who believed that we were the only intelligent life in the universe would be in a very small minority at this point. But I think there's just so many other aspects to disclosure beyond that, that those are the things that the authorities are worried about.
Yeah, and the great thing about your book that I really love is, you know, you write a novel. It's a suspense thriller novel, but in the back you have these appendices that really support some of the ideas that are presented through the storytelling in the back. Like you said, like the Robertson panel, you know, mysterious murders or accidents that happen to, you know, political people or others who get close to the truth, as we say.
Right.
You know, and other things like, you know, astronauts like Cooper, Mitchell, you know, they are people who didn't go out there to make money, you know, telling a tall tale. You know, these are people that are coming from, you know, an exposure to experiences and to agencies, being within those agencies, and coming back and just telling us their story. So, you know, when you have, and like you said, like, you're not making millions. No one's making millions off of this. So when you have people that can put their reputations on the line and they come out and say these things, you can't not pay attention to that.
No, and there are any number of astronauts, cosmonauts, and so forth involved in a space program that have testified, you know, that they have had these alien encounters, UFO encounters, you know, some of the encounters that they describe are quite vivid. So, I mean, if we're to believe that these guys are nuts, what are we letting them in? You know, why are we sit them in the space for? I mean, I can't think of a more credible witness than an astronaut. And then, of course, there's no denying it. I mean, as part of the disclosure effort, as you well know, the DOD approved the release of two videos within the last year, showing, you know, our pilots' encounters with UFOs, Navy pilots off the coast of California in one case, where these UFOs were showing up on radar, trailing this a group of ships in a naval exercise. They were there for days, and finally they sent up a couple of pilots to check them out, and they came back with camera evidence, and this had their radars locked on them and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, clearly, those UFOs didn't care if they were seen. They wanted to be seen. And they've demonstrated time and time again that they're technologically superior to our aircraft, conventional aircraft.
Right.
And
right.
So they could have gotten away, and yet they chose, apparently.
What is that?
To them.
Yeah. What is that? Why is there a tease? You know, why do they come just close enough so we can see them for a little bit, and then they're gonna go away? What's the point of that?
Look, we gotta assume that these are highly intelligent beings, and they've been visiting us. There's evidence for millennia. I mean, they found perfect depictions of UFOs on cave walls, and those folks didn't have a cable TV or sci-fi channel or any of that stuff. So there's plenty of stuff in literature from all over the world during every age about encounters with, you know, the people from the sky and from craft that they saw that are just read like present-day UFO sightings. So
mm-hmm.
they are very patient. They've been here as long as we have, apparently. And so I think they're taking, you know, they're in no hurry to make to land on the White House lawn. But for one thing that I've been told is there's hardly an inch of the Earth that we haven't explored yet. It's getting more difficult for them to hide their presence, and they don't really see why they should. I think, let me make this one point. One of the main reasons that they don't want to disclose is because people would accept that they're visitors from lonely, you know, regions of space coming here. What it would be difficult for them to deal with is the notion that the advanced non-human entities live here among us. You know, underground bases, undersea bases, and, you know, we share the planet with them. So I think that's one of the things that people are concerned, that the powers to be are concerned about.
Yeah. I'm going to read something from your book, a couple of excerpts. So earlier you had mentioned there's a character, Drake, in the book that was based on a real-life character.
Yes,
so he's
and Gladys.
In this, right. Okay.
Go ahead.
He's in this passage here. Seeing that something was up, Slade jumped to his feet. By the time he reached the door, it was practically over. In a move that amazed Slade, Drake delivered a swift and powerful blow to the man's throat. He staggered, panicking, as he fumbled for his gun. Drake grabbed the man's tie and swung him around, swimming him violently into the room and right into the way of Slade's pummeling fists. The man, his nose now broken and bleeding, reached for his gun, but it was too late. Like a magician pulling a rabbit out of a hat, Drake pulled an impressive piece of weaponry out of the inside pocket and pumped two bullets into the man's chest. Drake's very own silencer ensured that no one would come running to find out what was going on. The man gurgled briefly, and his eyes rolled into his head. As the lights went out, his final thoughts were that long-gone Saturday night in Johannesburg and his scumbag of a father. He had no regrets. The man had been right. Death would occur in this room today. And then a little bit later in the book, there's a little something else. Barely a second or so after Slade and Edwards caught sight of the small entity against the door, there was an ominous and unforeseen development. The flashlights of both men went suddenly dark. Completely out of the blue and unanticipated, the pair was now plunged into total darkness. Out of instinct, more than anything else, both men hit the ground, keeping their guns firmly fixed in the direction of the door, even though now they could barely see each other, never mind the door and the thing that was standing in front of it. So this is very, very adrenaline-rushing, exciting stuff. You know, how much of your own actual real-world investigation was, you know, adrenaline-pumping and exciting stuff for you?
Oh, almost all of it. I mean, as I said, I had a thriving business. I owned a small regional stock and bond brokerage firm. Mm-hmm. I was the rainmaker for the firm. I spent so much time on this investigation because it was just so incredibly all-consuming. And I have to say, even though it cost me hundreds of thousands of dollars, the people I got to meet and talk to and the things that I heard and know I could never be able to share with people left me satisfied that it was time and energy well spent. So
yeah.
No, I wouldn't give up the experience for anything.
Just to be that close must be exciting. Just to, you know, you don't need guns and fistfights to be enthralled in an investigation so close to tangible eyewitnesses and real world information that, I mean, you were on the receiving end of so much during that period.
Well, one of the things that really fascinated me was that, the news coverage was just absolutely incredible. I never knew there were so many morning news programs, talk radio shows. And I'd be up, my phone rang day and night, you know, because people were calling from all over the world.
Yeah.
And but the interest was just seemed I had one top reporter tell me, he said he was amazed, he had no idea the story would have such legs.
The UFO was so low people could see it with their own eyes, and it was gigantic, you know.
The credibility of the witnesses was just unassailable. We had three police officers who were in different parts of the Stephenville city proper that mm-hmm. came back to the station and were so excited to tell someone, and they just kind of bumped over each other's words, saying, "You'll never guess what I saw." And it turns out that within minutes, in different areas of, I mean, widespread area, they all had this sighting, and they sat down and drew a picture of this UFO, and they all agreed on, you know, this being what they saw. One officer was on a traffic stop, whatever you want to call it. He was sitting there with his radar gun, checking the traffic as it's coming along the highway, which was kind of a lonely highway, so there wasn't much traffic, but, it was notorious for speeders. So anyway, He said at one point, everything just went completely quiet. He couldn't understand what happened. You know, it was no crickets, nothing. I mean, you know, birds, no, everything just... like he had gone deaf or something. He said, I looked around and I didn't see. And then I looked up and he said, there was this enormous craft just hovering over me. He said, I didn't know what to do. Yeah. And he said, just sort of instinctively, I pointed my radar gun at the thing. He said, I didn't know what to do. And moved as the gun registered something like 14, 15 miles an hour. And then in the next instant, boom, it shot off. It was just a speck in the sky. Mm-hmm. So absolutely incredible speed. And no sound. A number of witnesses, had military backgrounds. Politicians, we had a constable, we had many law enforcement officers, because, you know, they're out and they're observant, they're trained observers, their testimony is accepted in court. And, but there were just hundreds of witnesses.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of the arguments are that, especially in those, years gone by, that maybe these were drones and people just were not aware of drones yet. But size matters. You know, you can't have a football-length drone and not hear it.
No. One of the initial reports was from a private pilot. And along with he was outdoors with two of his friends, one of them. They were a married couple. One of them, the lady had been an American Airlines flight attendant for many years, 15, 20 years. I forget exactly how long. But anyway, she had a lot of experience flying and seeing different types of aircraft. She'd flown on many different types of aircraft and so forth. But they all said that this was, you know, something that was much, much larger than aircraft carrier. I think I remember saying that it was a quarter of a mile wide and a mile long in appearance. And so all of the witnesses were consistent in saying this was huge. I mean, they used things like bigger than a super Walmart, bigger than the aircraft carriers, and biggest. They, in one sense, they said it's hard to imagine how something that large can just loom there in the sky. That's going to be disconcerting alone.
Yeah, it's like, also funny that someone would think of a Walmart to compare it to, if anything.
When I was interviewed on Dateline for NBC's Dateline. They were discussing what they've ranked as the top 10 UFO stories. And, so when they were interviewing me about Stephenville, I mentioned that one of the witnesses had said that it was bigger than the Super Walmart. So you just know that they followed up with a graphic of this Walmart with these rocket thrusters shooting off into space. You know, it's a, they had to make it a comical thing. So,
yeah.
I tell you, to the witnesses, when you saw their faces and held their hand and, you know, got them to sit and write down what they saw, thought and heard, and write and draw a picture of it. One thing, this is for people who don't know, Stephenville is right in the heart of Texas. And it's in it's a rural town with, you know, fewer than 20,000 people. The main industry is dairy. And, you know, all these small family dairies, you can't make a living off of 8, 10, 12 cows or whatever. So most of them have day jobs. You know, they go do their chores very, very early, then they work, and they come home and they do their chores at night. So these are people who are, the, you know, salt of the earth, hardworking folks. And for the most part, our witnesses were gray-haired people. I mean, let's face it, a lot of young people leave the country life because it's hard and they want to go to the big city. So it's.
I can imagine they're reticent, too.
No, as a matter of fact, they were all very forthcoming. And I think one of the positives of all of the media attention was that there were so many people. And with the number of people who were willing to talk, it made others less reluctant to talk. So we had a meeting because we had so many witnesses, we couldn't go. Typically, we would go and visit with them individually, but we just couldn't in a timely fashion. So I had 8 investigators with me at the time of the first meeting, and we had a meeting hall that had never had more than 200 people in it. They said that was filled wall to wall with people and reporters. They said they had over 500 people and they couldn't admit anybody else. So there was a tremendous amount of local interest. And all of our witnesses pretty much told the same story. Slight variations. Some people had dogs with them that were affected apparently right off the bat. Made them very submissive sound, you know. Even if they had been very big, aggressive dogs, one of them crawled under a pickup truck and so forth. So, so you cannot not believe these people. And, you know, when you have one witness or two witness or a group of 3 or 4 people together telling you something, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. And, of course, as the number of witnesses who tell a consistent story grows, then the more credibility it has. But when you have people from 3-county area, and, I mean, 3 counties in Texas could be as big as a lot of states, telling you the same story, then – you know, that is testimony, you know, that is court-worthy. I mean, so they have, you know, nothing to gain by it. But at any rate, it was a fascinating investigation. But one last point. So much media attention that my name was out there daily, boom, 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 boom. Early morning, midday, you know, newspapers, and then evening interviews and TV and so forth, which, although it was a drain on me, the benefit was that people knew who to contact, and I got many calls from folks saying, "Are you Ken Cherry, the guy, you know, he's an investigator?" Yes. Just a moment. Let me close my door. And they would be with some agency or whatnot, with, you know, a very informed person. And so it brought sources to me that all said, look, you know, my job, my career, my safety, my family safety could be in jeopardy, but here's something you need to know.
Yeah.
And as I got the first few calls, I kind of discounted it, but as I began to get more and more people from different walks of life telling me the same thing, you know, then, of course, that's when it begins to take on substance. Anyway.
I do have to wonder, though, it's, what, 2018, so about 10 years since Stephenville, and I think that was the last really big ship sighting. And I wonder if we're not going to see that at least for a while, because, you know, whoever is navigating those ships know that we all are armed with cameras with zoom lenses on them now. Whereas, you know, 2008, we didn't have the smartphones like we do. So, you know, prolific. So I do wonder, do you think that we may not see another big event again until the time comes?
Yeah, I certainly think we will, and I think that there are a number of revelations to come, and I'll tell you one. Let's put this down as a conspiracy theory.
Mm-hmm.
From source, I believe, but I don't have independent confirmation, is that President Trump has gained knowledge of these programs, whereas not a previous presidents have not been able to. And he is aware that we have a secret space program and have had for many years, and that obviously he was not the choice of the powers that be. And so they've been waging war against him. And one of the things he's done is threaten them with disclosure. And people don't give him credit for being as intelligent as he is, but
right.
Mostly he knows what he's saying. And something that I think that was made light of, that he was a purposeful act to threaten the powers that be when he said that we need a space force. That was a veiled threat to reveal our secret space program.
Interesting.
And he didn't say it once.
Mm-hmm.
He said it multiple times.
Right.
And I used to have a professor that said, if you want people to remember something, tell them you're going to tell them. Tell them. And then tell them you told them. So, and so
it works.
Three times, you know, when somebody says something, you know, more than once, that it means something. So, and particularly if you say it a second, third, you know, third time or more, then you better be going, okay, I better look into this. So, at any rate, I'll just leave you with that.
That's perfect. We're actually coming right up to the end here. It's been a great conversation. Ken, I love having you on here, and obviously I love our regular conversations as well. So if you want to find out more about Ken Cherry and his novelization of the Stephenville UFO incident, fictionalized, it's called Mark Slade Investigates the Stephenville UFO. You can go to Amazon.com. Click on it, find it. And there's a lot of great reviews for the book. So, and I've read it personally. So you're going to really enjoy this. And then once you finish the book, of course, there are the appendices, which give you some factual background to support the fictionalized story. So anyway, Ken, thanks for coming on again.
Thank you. I always enjoy our conversations. Take care, Alan.
All right. Good night, Ken. That's it for Paranormal Now. I do want to mention before we go off the air that, one, I actually feel a little bit better than I did at the beginning of the show. My wife, the love of my life, had mentioned that I should probably cleanse after spending so much time speaking about Alex Jones, and I already do feel better speaking to Ken after that segment. But, yeah, so why not do a little meditation tonight and you know, get myself a little more grounded and centered again. And to all of you out there, thank you so much for supporting this program. And I'd love to see you on Facebook, on Instagram. Instagram is at Paranormal Now. And that's it. So in the meantime, live in the mystery. And we'll see you next week for my next guest, Mike McCaskill, to talk about ghost hauntings and paranormal investigations.